Hello, everyone. Welcome to a solo podcast today on the Keenan Yoga podcast. I should mention that. And it's on, I don't know why I'm laughing, because it's on a serious subject, actually, of an emotional journey, and namely, this time, my emotional journey with the practice. So if that sounds intriguing, carry on listening. If it doesn't, then wait till next week and we have a sensible guest, a normal guest on again on the Keenan Yoga podcast. All right. But this is a solo one. And actually, to be honest, I wouldn't just talk about it. I don't think I have that much of interest in my personal life, really, to say. I haven't got to 45. That's not a good sign. A man actually had many people asking for my own personal experience with emotional healing and practice, what it's meant for me. And it's hard because it's ambiguous, first of all. We're always using these terms. Our practice is healing. It's emotional. It's cleansing, even purifying. I don't like the word purifying. I mean, Pitabi Joyce did use it. Purification, purification, purification. He used to say, it sounds like a spin doctor, a modern political spin doctor, doesn't it? This is the traditional context and framework of a tantric practice, which is essentially the practice we're doing, which is to purge undigested sediment of emotions through the body, by use of the body, through the body. And it's not classical yoga that we're doing here. I mean, as much as you need context of utter focus and one-pointed focus, like, you know, which is the mainstay of Patanjali, really, and his peers, Bhagavad Gita, etc. One-pointed focus, the focus, the mind, on one thing, and the exclusion of worldly distractions and distractions from the senses, etc., is yoga in the classical terms. But then in tantric, in the tantric milieu, as a yoga involves, it becomes something a little bit more body positive, let's say, which is, you know, using the body to, and also always in the to digest experience, always in the tantric texts, they use these words of like digestion and metaphors around this kind of visceral process of resolving and purging, both purging and absorbing, because both are relevant. Sometimes you have to purge stuff from the body, right? You have to get it out. It shouldn't be there at all, and sometimes you need to resolve it and integrate it in a way that's meaningful and comprehensible for you, but it needs integration. But in both cases, I think it was gradually understood that and even Patanjali understood it in a way when he said the karma of the body and he wouldn't just say of the body, but the karma for the individual consciousness was the problem. The karma is the ultimate problem. And at that point, it was simply, well, sit and contemplate, sit and contemplate your navel, or sit and contemplate oneness, and then those karmas would gradually evaporate. But I suppose, as if you were told to do that now, you probably would have a tough time with it and feel slightly useless and ineffective in your practice. I suppose similarly, people also started to demand more. How can we actually get rid of this stuff? I felt, if I'm going to get personal now, I felt, having done years of talking therapy, embarrassingly, from the ages of actually 11 or 12, I was taken to a psychiatrist suffering with anxiety and depression, so very early on. And that continued through my teens and in my early 20s, going to see all these different talking therapists and modalities along these lines, and being prescribed I think tranquilizers and antidepressants and various medications. I felt like I was caught in a web that I couldn't escape. That there was something in the body that, and I could talk myself till I was blue in the face. And I'm rather, not a stupid guy. Semi-intelligent. Are rather articulate, and I was able to kind of almost talk rings around the therapist, right? Tell them exactly the way it was, and nothing changed. I'd walk out of there, okay, I've said the piece again, I've said my stuff, and still the same feelings pertain because they're in the body and the talking has not touched them. And this is, I suppose, the main point that I want to ram home, is that when I started yoga, it was like, okay, this works. This is, immediately I had the feeling, okay, I don't fully feel better, of course, but this works and I know it works. I'm just convinced that this is the thing, because it's touching the very thing in the body that I can't actually get a hold of with my mind. Because obviously the emotions are literally in the body. And I think this is still, unfortunately, mainly not admitted, not understood, not agreed upon even in the modern context in the Western world, we as much as we say, oh, now, you know, we're holistic and it's a mind and body are always interrelated. You know, the people will say now, you're medical professionals, you know, they'll talk about the body related to the mind in terms of pain studies, etc. You know, apparently the body doesn't actually feel pain at all. It's all in the mind in terms of the receptors of pain being in the mind. There's still this reluctance to believe that the energy in the body is a viscerally embodied state. And yes, you can't necessarily, unless you're maybe, you know, in Patanjali's era, like, and maybe people were different then. They could resolve it simply with the mind. It certainly looks like that. When you look at Patanjali, you look at the Upanishads, you simply understand the stuff. You know, the one that understands, the Jnana Yogin, yeah, who understands, who is wise, they'll say in the Bhagavad Gita, the one who's wise, who understands this stuff, naturally is free of these karmic bonds, right? It's resolved almost like in one fell swoop, in one go, though all those things have dropped away. You know, the karma, all the past. And when we say karma, I don't mean to suggest there's anything. I don't mean to suggest you even have to take on the belief that there's past lives, etc. We can just look at karma as trauma or experiences, and doesn't have to be traumatic. All experiences stored in the body, because they have to be. They can't just be stored in the head. If you feel, you know, it makes only sense if you feel them in the body. Yeah, if you feel the experiences in the past in the body, then they can't, or probably wouldn't just be stored in the body. Sorry, in the head. They would also be stored in the body. Yeah. And in tantric terms, there's this focus around the spine and the central channel, Shushumna Nadi, the central channel, because those things are, and the spine itself are stored around the nerves of the spine. Yeah, it's the center of our being, our physical being. Yeah. So it only kind of makes sense that the karma or the past experiences, like sediment, yeah, like a, how do you say it? You know, like a rock, like when rocks erode from cliffs, right? And they, I remember this in geography, and that dust, that rock dust goes into the water, and gradually they settle on the floor, right? And you get these different stratas on the rock bed, different layers of experiences of life, yeah? Different, let's call them different periods of our life even, right? They all layer down, and it's very hard to go back to them because they're deep in the body then. You know, you can't, as I mentioned before, most people, I think, I mean, some people perhaps they can, but many people, it's not enough just trying to talk about it or understand it mentally, because it's literally in the body. And the two levels of being are some, although intertwined in a way that they're non-separable, body and mind, also remain somewhat separate as well from each other, right? You can't necessarily just think your way into an embodied state. You have to be it, right? It kind of only makes sense, right? You don't embody your embodiment, right? You can't just think you're embodied, right? So this tantric milieu kind of understood that and took that along with kind of cosmology of the body, the chakras and the nadis, right? You've got Ida, Pingala, the two main nadis that come either side of the spine, and Shushumna. Ida is essentially the moon, passive. We would have said before feminine, but we don't talk in these ways anymore. Pingala is the sun, the red channel, the active, the rajasic element of our being, right? So these are also, we could say psychologically, these two elements of ourselves need to be resolved, right? The masculine, feminine, if you want to talk in this way, or the active and the passive elements of our being, or the conscious and subconscious elements of our being, right? You know, how much we are the individual, for example, and how much we yield to being consciousness itself, or even just on a practical level, how much we yield to considering other people's perspectives. Because if you completely put yourself into considering other people's perspectives and don't hold your own, then you're kind of lost. But if you hold your own too rigidly, then that's not nice either. You're super isolated. So, you know, we can frame this Ida Pingala Shushumna in this way, you know, which is more practical, or we can say literally, which I subscribe to as well, in both terms, that the Shushumna Nadi, the spine, the nerves around the spine, literally hold these stored past experiences and emotions and thoughts, and essentially not only do they implicate the present, but they're unresolved as well. And some of them don't belong there because they're unresolved, as I mentioned earlier. They should be purged, right? And some of them do belong there, but they haven't been resolved, right? You haven't fully understood what they mean or integrated them into your current sense of self, right? Or your current sense of being in the world, right? So something needs to be done. And I think Tantra realized this all too well. And that's why I always suggest, you know, read some of the tantric texts, whether, you know, Garuda Samhita, Shiva Samhita, Yoga Yajnavalkya, all these tongue twisters, Ashtavakra Gita, there's many of them, Yoga Bija, that they all given us some idea of the tantric idea of what I suggest we're doing today, which is very different to the classical yoga that we're more familiar with, Patanjali, Bhagavad Gita, etc. But yet, then, not to say those things are not useful, but they're perhaps less relevant to the current embodied practices that we're doing than the tantric aspect of literally working with the energy in the body, right? And that's why we're always kind of compressing the body in the yoga stretches, or we should be, right? Using compressive stretches, not just passive stretches, you know, when you stretch out of yourself, but pulling together, compressing the energy, stimulating the spine by exerting internal pressure on the spine, yeah, which is often conceived of in the tantric language as Mount Meru, the spinal channel. And in doing so, in stimulating the spine, it's like you have the opportunity to look again, which is what I always really felt like I wanted, a fresh start in the emotional, my emotional color palettes, you know, in my psyche, right? I've been years of being off and on depressed, off and on chronically anxious, medicated at many points in my childhood and adolescent, and I wanted a fresh start to draw a line under these things, and stirring up the spine and coming back into emotions again, it gave me the opportunity, and it was painful. I mean, you know, to speak in a more in a freer, easier way for me now, you know, there were times when I was incredibly anxious coming into practice because it was going into that fear. And I, you know, and it's hard to say things that aren't cliches, but it, you know, when you go into the body and it's the place of those emotions, inevitably you start to feel, not inevitably, but often you can start to feel anxious. I still can feel it today before moving my body. I start to feel that anxiety. I don't even know why. It's because subconsciously, I think there's all those emotions, all those things that are stored in the body that I'm, you know, that cause fear. And I think fear generally because you don't know them, because you're confused about what you don't know. It's not like they should be frightening. It's that they're unresolved and essentially therefore confusing, or they don't belong there. Therefore they're confusing. It's not like we need to feel frightened about those things, or there's that fear response that isn't relevant anymore that needs to be let go of, right? But wasn't really expressed at the time because we didn't have the opportunity to express that fear at the time, but that anxiety, that, you know, real emotional reaction at the time, because we were just trying to deal with the time, right? So Bessel van der Kolk and Peter A. Levine in Taming the Tiger speak about this a lot, that, you know, like a gazelle having been chased by a lion doesn't have the time to digest that experience until later. It's just trying to get away. Right, but when the lion, you know, when it escapes the lion, it goes to the water, wherever it's drinking. You know, they often go to these water little oases in the desert. You know, if you've ever done a safari, that's where you go when you want to see a lion. Unfortunately, because it's attracted there by all these animals that go to the water area. Right, but when it goes back to its herd and it starts shaking, they've observed this. Right? It's viscerally getting rid of this emotion. And we're doing the same thing, you know, in the yoga. We're coming back into that emotion, which is where we have to do, in a safe space. Yeah. Because what you've done with the yoga now, and this is the use of ritual, this is the use of repetition, which is to say ritual, yeah, because we're repeating something, which is super helpful, because any religion is based on ritual, and any ritual is based simply upon repetition without an obvious goal. It's not the repetition of practice to be a tennis player or a sprinter, because that's got an obvious goal, right? There's repetition there for a reason. But this repetition we're doing is kind of reasonless, really. You know, it's like, why do you want to be an expert putting your leg behind the head unless you're going to be a sponsored yogi, or, you know, I don't know. I'm sure there are a few of them, you know, sponsored for Lululemon or whatever. But generally speaking, it's kind of useless for anything. It's kind of useless. So, you know, ritual without an obvious focus, or repetition without an obvious focus, becomes ritual, which is a consecrated space with a start and an end and space in the middle. Yeah. Space in the middle to be. Yep. And that space, in that safe space, because you've got a start and an end, and you surround yourself with a repetition, so you've got an obvious focus and support. Yeah, support of many techniques to focus your mind on and keep you steady, mentally steady, like a physical mantra, you know, the idea of mantra, the word, the etymology of mantra, mind protection, mind control. I think as a net, man is mind, hence man, thinking control. Yeah, man to think, and try to net, or I think latterly control. So, you know, we're doing a physical mantra here, which is a physical control. You put yourself in a literal physical mandala. You know, a mandala is one of those sacred geometrical drawings that you see in India a lot in front of gates and stuff. You put yourself physically there. And within that sacred space, you've consecrated yourself. It's not sacred because it is. It's sacred because you've made it such. Yeah, this is the real ritual, not any magic spell. It's not superstition. We're not talking about a magic spell here. Yeah, right. You know, a magic spell given to you by Patabi Joyce or your Ashtanga teacher following Shirachi Joyce. It's your own ritual, really. You have to take responsibility for your ritual. Yeah. Once you've created that space, you go into that space, you allow things to come up because they will come up. Yeah. In that space because they're allowed to come up because you're safe, right? You should be anyway. Yeah. That's why you have to find a quiet place where you won't be disturbed. Similar place every day. Repeat the ritual. Yeah. Roughly. Doesn't have to be exact. Again, we're not talking about a magic spell here. Exactly the right ritual and you magic combination locked to enlightenment. No, no, no. It doesn't work like that. Yeah. This is practical. All this stuff is practical, right? It's a practical usage. Original rituals were practical. You know, all the tantric stuff, as much as it's framed around esoteric and perhaps opaque and symbolic language that's purposefully confusing, perhaps, you know, essentially it's just, you know, it's just demanding that you use a teacher with you to do this stuff, because that's helpful as well. Someone to support you and help you along the way to see your errors in it and just basically, you know, or, you know, where you might be, you know, pointed in the direction you might have been going wrong, right? Yeah, but it's not anything magical. Let's go back to that point again. This is most practical instruction I'm offering here about viscerally purging trauma in your body, yeah, from your body, through your body. So going back to the stuff that I know most well now because I experienced it. Yeah, I mean, I remember every day I'd practice in the evening and climbing up the stairs to my flat after work, I'd feel like today I can't do it. You know, either I'd feel sick, yeah, I'd feel like I was getting ill, or I'd feel start to feel so anxious, I feel like I just have to lie down. I can't, you know, and it would come upon me like, you know, like 20 minutes before I might have been feeling fine. I might have already been anxious because that was a current experience. And, you know, like, to be perfectly honest, it still could be a current experience. You know, I'm dealing with, you know, these negative mind states, I think, as we all are to differing degrees these days, right? At the point is they don't overwhelm me anymore. I can deal with them, you know, and put them to use. Anyway, so, you know, this stuff happened for many years. I think for the first 10 years of just feeling the practice was, how can I put it? Just so intense, such an intense experience of feeling emotions arising in the body and keeping on practicing and keeping on with them, just with them, and then going through them. Because I think a lot of the time it's like the real problem is that we put the kind of perceived monster. We have these feelings that are overwhelming and we just can't, there's no point in the day when you can really experience them, generally speaking, right? I mean, that's the beauty of meditation, you know, just sitting there, you might allow the things to come up because when else, just on a practical level, again, framing meditation more practically, because when else in the day are you actually going to give yourself the time to just deal with all this stuff that you've experienced, even in one day, you know, let alone a lifetime of stuff, right? You know, and it doesn't come up all at once, right? You can't just sit down in front of the TV and expect to be faced with all this stuff that you need to just order carefully and neatly into a box again. You know, it comes up when it will, when you feel safe, when you feel supported, you know, like psychologically and emotionally, not only from inside, but obviously from the outside as well, by others and by such situations around you. It'll come up in its own accord. Yeah. So oftentimes, actually, it's when we feel, you know, relaxed, right? Like times like when you are with a partner who feels supported by, when you are in a situation of having holidays or vacations, you know, and you feel like you can let go, the things actually come up and it's hard, you know, with a daily grind, as it were. That's, again, somewhat easier because you just keep your head down, go and lock down, you know, metaphorically speaking, you're kind of on a semi-lockdown because you've got to get stuff done, you know, and that's natural, reasonable, and appropriate. Also appropriate. You can't wear your heart on your sleeve. You can't be a basket case in the corner for your daily work, you know. But then there also has to be a certain space in the day for you to just go back into the stuff and let stuff come up where it comes up, because otherwise you've just got all these monsters in the cupboard and they're actually more scary in the cupboard than they are out in front of your face. Where you say, well, look, you know, because when you see them, yeah, then you're not in that experience anymore. Yeah. They're not, you know, it's like you can let go. It's like when you see something you felt and experienced and that's no longer you and that's no longer the situation and you're in the safe context of the practice and the framework of the ritual that is the physical mandala I'm suggesting. Used too many words there, didn't I? you know, it's like vapor or steam arising in the pure light of day, the sun of your just being there just evaporates it. Yeah. It's a bit poetic, isn't it? It's a bit Russell Brand, but nevertheless, I'm sure he's not listening anymore. Sorry, Russell, if you are. It's that feeling that, you know, when you can bring things to light and allow them to be there, you don't have to do anything. It's not like we're trying to do something here. It's just like we're trying to let come up what needs to come up in the safe and contained space. Yeah. And on a practical level, just to go back to more practical stuff now, there's just the physical routine lends to obvious daily routines that are more logistically helpful for you, right? I mean, in these day and age, we don't have any ritual, you know, to support our consciousness, to support our sense of self in the world. You know, if you go back to India, you know, if you go to India, or we look at India, you know, it's still, even in the modern day, especially the older people, of course, they'll be doing prayers when they wake up. They'll be doing the Rangoli, the little drawings, you know, sacred drawings in front of the house and doors in the morning. They'll be doing ritual bathing, all kinds of things inform their daily life. Because I think as emotional beings in a world of absolute uncertainty, if we're completely honest, and it's getting no less uncertain as we go on, right? I think we can all agree there. We need these things to support and contain us, little pit stops, little moments in the day where we come back to ourselves and feel supported by these little rituals that we create, yeah? So we can kind of feel supported in the uncertainty that is life, yeah? Because we're in free fall, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, especially nowadays on a more practical level. We are. So, you know, we don't have those rituals. So introducing some ritual for yourself, albeit simply an asana practice in the morning, yeah, you can do it in a similar time of day or the evening, right? First, you know there's a space every day to come back to where you can just be. You don't have to be a certain way. There's no expectations on your role. You don't have to relate as a child, as a sibling, as a boss or as an employee, yeah, as a parent. You're able to just be as you are. And there's so few times in our life that we get that possibility. Yep. So there's a space in the day that you'll be okay in. Yeah. And that, I mean, it sounds like, I don't know what it sounds like to you, but that for me is huge. Yep. Just knowing however anxious I felt, whatever I felt, I knew there'll be a time in the day when I feel I could be and allow myself to be as I needed to be. Just incredibly reassuring that there was going to be a time in the day where I would be all right, yeah, for an hour and a half or whatever, an hour, 40 minutes, half an hour, doesn't really matter the period of time, just the fact that there would be a time, yeah, it would be allowed to be like that, yeah. And secondly, you know, just the logistics, as I've spoken to you before about, that you've got a routine now, you've got a routine to structure better choices around, you're going to make better choices, you're going to feel a bit healthier, you're going to eat better, that's going to affect your, you know, I think the stomach is often said to be the second brain these days. What you eat is going to hugely affect your mind state, yeah? I spent, you know, early 20s eating terribly, like eating, I would run on a diet of sugar and coffee, just almost because I was anxious. It was a kind of homeopathically somehow, like in homeopathy, right? Like treats like. It was almost add and kind of like those stimulants to the pot, and somehow, in some times it worked to counterbalance them a bit. Anyways, my diet was terrible and it didn't really help me. Ultimately, it doesn't help you to have a diet of sugar and coffee, obviously. So you need to eat properly. You need to make healthy choices. Those inform you the way you act and the way you behave, obviously. And sleep is the other thing. You know, the practice will help you sleep. You know, you've done something physical every day. That really helps. You know, doing some exercise helps you sleep. And you have then this ritual of lifestyle. And probably more than anything, really, having that routine, the more kind of esoteric way that I suggested, but just the logistics, and I've spoken to you about this before, the logistics of having a structure for your daily life really, really helps. You know, cannot be underestimated. You know, practical to the practice again works practically. Even the ritual space works practically, right? So, what else can I say about this? It doesn't happen all at once. I'm definitely not suggesting that you might not continue if you're taking medication. We're taking medication as well. I'm certainly not suggesting that it would be a one-stop shop or a general panacea or magic wand. I've also used many other modalities over the years combined with the yoga. I mentioned homeopathy. Don't want to get hung up here, but I've had some results with homeopathy. Acupuncture as well have been really helpful. Simply massage, you know, it's been really useful. Not any special massage, you know, just a relaxing massage, right? Talking therapies have their place. You know, I've definitely, you know, for a while experienced very great benefits from talking stuff out. If you haven't before, you have to. If you haven't before, you have to. But after a certain point, I think they don't touch the deeper levels of emotion because they're in the physical body, right? You combine these things with the yoga practice and they work together. But I think to suggest that the yoga practice will do everything, I think is perhaps wishful thinking or magical thinking. I think you need also to use other areas of support, because also what the yoga practice is doing is stimulating that sediment that's stored in your body by compression, to repeat myself, by compressive stretches and the breathing. Like it's like you add pressure to pressure, right? The breathing creates a certain pressure in the abdominal and the thoracic cavities. Basically, you're inside your body, there's space, right? Mainly your space, right? You know, the yoga Yajnavalkya talks about the body being a pot, talks about gata yoga, a pot yoga. The body is a pot, right? Inside, you've just got space, right? You've got two cavities, abdominal, thoracic. Inside that space, you compress, you make more pressure. That pressure stimulates the nerves of the spine, which are in the center of this space, right? So one way to look at it. And you do that by breathing in a way that creates pressure, using the muscular locks in a way that creates pressure, and using the posture, using your very posture itself in a way that keeps a certain tension, a right tension of the body, right? And then we go back to obviously what I just paraphrased there, what mansplained was yoga Tristana, the Tristana, the fundamental techniques that Patabi Joyce mentioned. Yeah, 3 points, try three sthana places, 3 points of attention. Yeah. And he was the first person to come up with this term, but that's there if you read Krishnamacharya's Yoga Makaranda as well. And I totally recommend that book to read, and you'll get a better idea of kind of like what Patabi Joyce was talking about. And also that Patabi Joyce also innovated as well, that Krishnamacharya innovated, you know, and Patabi Joyce also innovated from his teachings from Krishnamacharya. Yeah. But I don't need to go further into that now. So it's basically everything is space. And creating a ritual space outside, you're able to come into creating a greater ritual space inside. And a lot of it is simply letting the confusion arise, because the fear, as I mentioned before, is inappropriate most of the time. Or you need to go into it in order to come out the other end. Yeah, because hiding it away, it just becomes bigger. Yeah, and getting into the body is, for me, is and was the most effective way. And I spoke to someone on a podcast the other day. They were saying for them it was meditation. For me it was the body, because I was already too much in my head, and you just feel disassociated from the body then. And just to get into the body and focus on stuff that isn't actually dwelling on your feelings and dwelling on your emotions and dwelling on your past, you know, and you focus on these specific points of attention. Yep. Yeah, and you create a framework. And within that framework, then you can look at things differently. For me, it was like the yoga practice also allowed me to, like, wiping the slate clean each day. Otherwise, you kind of go to bed having had a day of struggling with, you know, emotions or difficult mental states, emotional states, yeah? And then you come the other morning. Why should you feel different? You think about them again. You perpetuate the same experience the next day, or like panic attacks. They generally, you know, thinking about the panic attack leads to a panic, and you're in this kind of vicious, terrible, terrible, horrible, vicious cycle, which I experienced for a long time. You couldn't, it's like you can't get out of it, you know? And the yoga practice just draws a line every day. Okay, you can start afresh. Yeah. You've wiped the slate clean. You've gone there. You've allowed what can come up currently to come up. And now you can start again. Yeah. Finally, to conclude my chat today, I want to also talk about the group context. First of all, you're not doing this alone. Oftentimes you're doing it in a group. That's incredibly helpful, right? Because you've got other, you're doing something personal, but you're surrounded by support, right? You're not alone. I think most of these feelings are defined in some form or fashion. You know, this, what we're talking about here, these difficult emotional feelings, by aloneness. You feel alone with it. Yeah. And then you're doing this thing, which is going into yourself, but you're surrounded by people also doing the same. So you're in a public context of support, but not obvious support in the way that there's not people pestering you, or you're telling you what to feel, or, you know, you're not, you know, it's kind of in some kind of hugging therapy workshop or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you're in a private context in a group setting. Yeah. Very interesting. I think somewhat a lucky happenstance. I don't think it was meant to necessarily be that way, because yoga was always traditionally, over the thousands of millennium before, a classical, classically isolated practice. You do it on your own in a forest, or, you know, very much in private. You can see that in the Bhagavad Gita, very much instructed as a private practice. You go to the forest on your own, you know, in seclusion. You know, it's always that way. Yeah. But now we're doing something in a public context, but in a private, internal world as well, right? So we're bringing these two worlds together. And also just, you know, just understanding oneself as an individual in a public context, you know, just in a slightly more practical sense, can also be incredibly helpful. Not only are you supported by other people, yeah, whilst you might remain essentially unknown to them, yeah, you don't have to be known to them. You know, it's kind of liberating, right? There's people around you. You have this sense of group care, group support, collectivity, but you don't have to be a person, a known person to them. Yeah, you can, you know, remain in your own world and in private as well, right? So it's an interesting place to be, but also in the group you can also relate. Yeah, you have the opportunity to relate, and in that we kind of also, in this particular instance, as in many other instances in life, we have the opportunity to relate our private context of inner experience to our outer persona, which is the I think the central battle of us in the modern world, especially now when the outer context of ourselves, social being, our social selves in the world, has become so inordinately strong, and our inner sense of self, in comparison or at the expense of our outer sense of being, has become crushed into a tiny corner and not experienced at all. We've objectified ourselves and become completely externalized, two-dimensional characters that on the outside and very much no space to experience ourselves in our inner world anymore. That's not being given any veracity, any autonomy, any space, right? So this is also a really, especially now, a current battle, but it has always been the private level of self to the public level of expression of self, and trying to resolve that issue, right? Because we feel one way on the inside, but we constantly ask on the outside to present ourselves in different ways. And the discrepancy or discordancy, often the difference between the two states, how we present ourselves on the outside, how we feel on the inside, is often incredibly painful because it's different, right? We don't feel authentic. We don't feel we're being and experiencing ourselves at that point authentically. Anyways, I think that's a bit deep, isn't it? And perhaps confusing somewhat. So how can I wrap this up in a more simplest terms to leave on a good note? I think finally it gives you self-trust, I suppose, if that's what I come back to in the end, is that having said to yourself you'll do something every day and keeping that commitment, it gives you a sense of integrity and trust in yourself again, especially if you felt like you're out of control and having to take medications and perhaps self-medicating and doing all things that aren't helpful for yourself. You lose a sense of self-trust and conviction about yourself. Well, I did anyway, yeah. And coming back to doing something good for yourself every day, Yeah, when you maybe you don't feel like you want to necessarily, right? Because that's part of it, right? You might not feel that you're good enough to deserve doing good stuff for yourself. But doing something anyway that you know is good for yourself, yeah, and good for the world as well, that, you know, you're doing something good for yourself, but everyone else, you know, who comes in contact with you. And I believe it's also, we're one consciousness, so we are raising a collective vibration here, although that sounds a bit woo-woo. I'm a practical kind of guy, right? So I do still believe that. So that must give you pause for thought. Having done this for so many years, I definitely have that conviction. You know, it gives you that sense of integrity back to yourself, a sense that you can, you know, you are committed every day and you can follow through. You know, you can follow through. And that's why you don't want to let yourself down here. You know, even getting on your mat, doing a sun salutation and putting it away again hasn't let yourself down, right? Doesn't mean you have to get on the mat and do hours of practice, quite the opposite. But you must try not to let yourself down and cave in to not being able to do it. As I said, I got on the mat feeling so depressed at times, so anxious at times. Really? I don't know whether, I'm sure that some of you have experienced very high levels of this yourself, but I cannot underemphasize how, I'm not just saying this, I really, really, I was, very, very anxious, very, very depressed, very. And having done those practices, I left a really almost, you could say, a different person afterwards, almost after every single time. I did leave a completely different mindset. And I went through it and I was able to go through it. Try as hard as you can because it does get better. And also it does get better and it does get easier. And obviously not just over time, but even in that one practice, yeah, the more you carry on, the more you'll just ease yourself into it, because when you're feeling that way, you feel a negativity towards yourself. And, the sad thing is you don't want to do good things to yourself. You don't want to do good things to and for yourself. That's the irony of it and the vicious circle we can fall into here, right? So I think some of these things that I'm saying are really, not to blow my own trumpet here, but they're really important to be heard and to be expressed by someone, who has done the practice a long time as well and who has, I suppose, some social standing in the Ashtanga circles now, but why or wherefore, I don't know. I'm saying these things, so I hope they've been helpful. But the last thing I want to say, not to leave on a bum note, a negative note, is that after a while, what I noticed also is that the practice can also be used in the opposite way. In practicing intensely, it can stir things up and get things out and get things in the open, and then you purge these emotions. But also, in practicing intensely, for some weird and wonderful reason, not so wonderful, it can put a lid on things. You can almost squash your emotions by practicing over intensely. You can almost numb yourself. It's like numbing yourself by practicing intensely. And so what I want to say here is that over years, I also knew after the initial phases, the first, say, 8 or 10 years of really going into emotions, then I noticed after a while what I would do is I would practice intensely, too intensely. And you know what intensity means. It means using the body too strongly, pushing myself, over-breathing, over-bunders, over-exertion, over-deepening, inverted commas, postures. Yep. Not realizing that this whole energy was a really subtle thing. And as soon as you grip something, you squash it. As soon as you try and grip your energy, you lost it. Yeah. So you could put a lid on things. Yep. So you just be aware that the practice can be used also for suppression. Yep. Suppressing your emotions, suppressing things that should come up. Yep. And I don't know when things changed again. I think when I didn't practice so intensely and when I wasn't pushing myself so physically, because that goal orientation again, that can crush that you then cover over again, coming back to yourself and abiding in the ritual space, because it's no longer ritual because the repetition has been used for some particular goal. The repetition hasn't been used to consecrate the space of being, the space to come into, because now you're just going in a linear direction away from yourself to achieve, to validate yourself externally once more. Yeah. When you stop doing this, when you stop pushing, when you use the techniques in terms of balancing, yeah, when you use the techniques to try and create some kind of mental equanimity, it's painful again. Yeah? It's frightening again. That's why we don't do it that often. That's why it's easy to push. Yeah, because just to be with yourself is hard. It's easier to try and be something other. So just not to try and be something other is painful and frightening. Yeah. And that's why I want to say that the trap then, the pitfall again, after the initial emotional catharsis, is to go back to putting a lid on things by overstraining, over practicing. Yeah. So just be aware of that, and how to come back into that is the second part of the journey, I suppose. And maybe I'll do another podcast. If you like this one, let me know. If you find I've said anything of interest and not just been rambling on, please let me know. And let me know what you want me to talk on next, or if you want me to clarify any of these points, because I realize I've been saying very quickly, unfortunately, especially if you're not a native speaker. I apologize. It's kind of my style of delivery, I suppose. But some things that are quite complex, some things that take more thought and reflection upon. So maybe listen to it again, because I do feel that this stuff is really important and worthy of more attention, in the world generally, and obviously in the yoga world, and especially in the Ashtanga world, which often uses ritual and repetition for goal-oriented purposes, and perhaps increasingly so. So I'd like to take the practice back to the original emotional healing that I felt defined the early teachers and teaching of it. Anyway, hope you've enjoyed it, and if it's been worthwhile at all to listen to, then share it around and let me know what you think, and let me know what you want me to talk on next. I'd love to hear, and I'm at your service in terms of talking about anything. If you made it to the end of this, then just don't forget to subscribe and like the podcast and leave a review if you've enjoyed it. That really helps the algorithms and whatever. I don't really know much about this stuff, but it helps, right? It helps share it to a broader community, and that's a service that you can do to me if you've at all enjoyed anything I've shared with you today. So I'll see you again next week for the normal episode with a guest. I'll see you then, and until then, take care and have as good a week, or have the week you're gonna have. All right, take care for now.